We have an update this morning on what's called the burqa debate in France. The question is whether the full head and body covering worn by many Muslim women should be banned. Today, a French commission recommended that it be outlawed in public buildings like schools and hospitals. The country's been having this discussion for more than 6 months, and as Eleanor Beardsley reports, it's not over yet.
The burqa debate erupted last summer when President Nicolas Sarkozy, out of the blue, declared the all-encompassing face-covering veil unwelcome in France.
Le problème de la burqa n'est pas un problème religieux.
The burqa is not a religious problem, he told the French Parliament in a State of the Union-style address. It's a problem of freedom and the dignity of women. Sarkozy said the burqa, which allows the wearer to see through a cloth mesh, and its close cousin, the niqab, which leaves a slit for the eyes, subjugate women. A commission began looking into the garment. Its report out this morning recommends that Parliament ban it from public buildings, but not the streets. Jean-François Copé, leader of Sarkozy's majority party in Parliament, believes France needs a solid law against the burqa.
The two reasons why we have to implement this legislation is to respect the rights of women, and second, it's a question of security. Who can imagine that people can just walk everywhere in the country with a burqa, without the possibility for us to recognize their face?
France is home to Europe's largest Muslim minority, but the sight of fully veiled women is not an everyday occurrence in most parts of the country. While the shoppers and vendors at a street market in the north of Paris are mostly immigrants from Africa and the Maghreb, no one's dressed in a burqa or niqab today. Like many, 22-year-old Salima Zebag is wearing a headscarf or hijab. I think it's inadmissible in a country of so-called liberty to forbid people to wear what they want, says Zebag.
It's not a question of tolerance. We are very tolerant. Everybody can have his own religion, no problem with that. But it has to be subordinated to the law of the Republic, and the law say you have to show your face.
Jean-François Copé has been pounding home that message. Recently, in a popular late-night talk show watched by millions of French people, Copé faced off with a woman wearing a niqab who went by the name of Delilah. I'm sorry, I just can't have a real conversation with you because I can't see you, said a frustrated Copé to the black-clad woman. While polls show a majority of French people now support banning the burqa in public, the report estimates that only between 300 and 2,000 women in France may actually wear it. Many lawmakers are afraid that a draconian law would be pointless and further stigmatize Muslims who are already bristling after a series of town hall-style debates on national identity in France have unleashed a barrage of anti-Islamic sentiment. Mohamed El Madani, who describes himself as a law-abiding, voting French citizen, says banning burqas, like banning minarets in Switzerland, is a blow to Muslims and a political ploy.
For us Muslims, it's very simple, in fact. The party of the president is trying to make the people of the extreme right to make them vote for the UMP, for the president's party.
Beyond Sarkozy, the debate over banning the burqa isn't so clear-cut. Politicians from the left and right are for and against it, and a prominent imam has come out for the ban, as has a mainstream Muslim women's group. And while most French Muslims probably do feel stigmatized by the burqa debate, they embrace France's strict separation of religion and the state. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
A private school in Northern Virginia's Fairfax County wants to expand to serve more students, and it needs the county's approval. Not a big deal, usually. But this school is Islamic and funded by the government of Saudi Arabia. So what began as a local land use issue has grown into a broader discussion of the school, its teachings, and the relationships between Muslims and non-Muslims in this country. NPR's Jamie Tarabay has the story.
This story begins last summer, and to hear Pat Herity tell it, this is a story about traffic.
You can't drive Pope's Head Road. You can't look at Pope's Head Road. I couldn't imagine putting another car per 6 seconds on the Pope's Head Road.
Or standing at the front of a driveway with a white picket gate. Beyond the driveway, up a hill, past the security guard, shaded by tall trees, is the ISA, the Islamic Saudi Academy. In August, the county's Board of Supervisors approved the academy's bid to expand its campus and double the number of students who come here to about 500. This gate is the only entry and exit point.
They say they want them to use this exit up here, come down this way, but they have to make a left-hand turn into here. Guess which way the commuters are coming in the morning?
Herity is the supervisor for the Springfield District. He voted against the bid. This is his area. He graduated from a local high school, and the people who live here are his constituents. As we're talking, Beth Parker, who's lived next door for 33 years, is driving by, but she pulls over when she spots Herity. She complains that since the academy got its approval, no one's cut the grass.
Look at the maintenance of the place. I cannot tell you what we've gone through ever since they've owned it to try to get them to maintain the fence to where it's relevant to the neighborhood, keeping the land mowed and neat looking. And they did it all during this process. And once they got it, you can see what it looks like now.
She's mad that politics got in the way of what she says is strictly a land use issue. But scratch the surface, and it becomes very clear, very quickly, that this is about more than traffic.
Wahhabist Sharia compliant institution.
This is what happened when the board met to discuss the academy's application. People lined up for hours to speak at public hearings.
And what are the results of the health department's action item from the last planning commission about an assessment of the septic system?
That's John Cosgrove, who began his speaking time asking about the septic system at the campus. He ended it with this.
Because I submit no Catholic textbook has anything near the venom and demonstrated incitement to murder as these Islamic side textbooks. Rather than rushing to congratulate them for what they've removed, why don't we ask them the fundamental question of what was it doing there for 20 years in the first place?
Thank you, Mr. Cosgrove.
This went on for hours, people first bringing up traffic issues, then invariably turning the talk towards religion. People travelled from other states to speak. Conservative Christian groups got involved. And it put the people who send their kids to the school on the defensive. People like Roseanne Fayez, whose seven-year-old son goes there.
He can speak, read, and write Arabic almost as well as he can English. He's learning Islamic studies, understanding of respect between Muslims and non-Muslims. If we were breeding terrorists, if there was any little tinge of truth to anything that these people have been saying before, you would be hearing about it because of the students.
Iman Kandil, a former ISA student and MIT graduate, also spoke up.
In addition to the strong background in math and science that I got at ISA, the greatest lessons that I've learned at ISA are those of community service and giving back. We are not taught to enforce Sharia law. We are not taught to destroy the Constitution.
But there are issues. A former valedictorian is serving a life sentence convicted of plotting to assassinate President Bush. A former principal was arrested because instead of reporting a complaint from one of his students about sexual abuse at home, he deleted the report and returned the child to her father. And there are the textbooks.
These are ideological material that are indoctrinating young students in hatred.
Ali Ahmed, a Saudi dissident, works for the Gulf Institute. He's been studying the ISA's curriculum for nearly 10 years. He flips through one of the Islamic studies textbooks.
This is 10th grade. If you are not a believer in their interpretation of the religion, you are not protected. Your blood, your honor, your property is up for grabs. And that explains the suicide bombing a lot. Because how do you convince somebody to walk into a crowded market and blow themselves up? Because these people, their life worth is zero.
In 2007, a bipartisan federal commission on international religious freedom called for the school to be shut while the government examined its textbooks. It was concerned the school promoted religious intolerance and violence against people who aren't Muslim. The school responded by erasing paragraphs from textbooks. The ISA had initially agreed to let NPR visit its campus, but cancelled at the last minute. An email said the school administrators were tired of all the media coverage and didn't want any more, especially since they got the approval to expand. So for now, the controversy continues, and so does the pressure on local politicians. Michael Fry is on the Board of Supervisors. He voted yes and says he still cops heat for that. One man came up to him at a local supermarket on a Sunday morning after Fry had taken his dog for a walk.
He said, I can't believe that you voted that way, and you call yourself a conservative. And he tried to get a little aggressive. And I said, first of all, let me just say, I don't believe that anybody who wants local government to be reading texts and making decisions on schools based on what they teach is a conservative. I said, to me, that is one of the biggest intrusions you could possibly imagine.
The State Department agrees. Conservative Christian groups who've lobbied for the school to be closed say because it's funded by the Saudi government, the State Department should intervene. But the State Department says it's a private school, not a foreign mission, and it has no role in accrediting or managing the ISA. Fry points out that two Christian schools also filed applications to expand last year. No one questioned their textbooks.
How do I know that this Christian school isn't teaching hatred against non-Christians? I said, I didn't read their text. But if you want me to start to base land use decisions on those, terribly, terribly slippery slope.
For now, Fairfax County's waiting for the school to submit its site plans. Before expansion can even begin at the academy, the county will have to install left and right turns into the driveway from Pope's Head Road. So that two-lane winding country road will get a little wider. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Imagine the Pope, dressed in his white robes and wearing his half-moon glasses, hunched over a laptop, blogging. Probably not going to happen, although Benedict XVI does have a Facebook page. But in a recent message, he called on priests to proclaim the gospel through blogs, videos, and websites. NPR's Barbara Bradley Haggerty reports.
The call to blog took a lot of people by surprise. After all, the 82-year-old Pope from Bavaria is better known for his conservative doctrine and revival of the Latin Mass than for his computer savvy. At first, Father James Martin was startled as well. He's author of The Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything and blogs each day for the Catholic magazine America. But then Martin thought, surely Jesus would blog if he were on the earth today. He didn't sit at home and wait for people to come to him.
He went out and he met people, you know, by the Sea of Galilee who were fishing. He went into tax collectors' booths. He went into synagogues. He went all over the place. And so we need to, sort of figuratively speaking, go out to the ends of the earth, which includes, right now, the blogosphere.
Now, the Pope has not announced his own blog. But if he does, he might be wise to listen to the experts.
As a blogger, let me just say I have some advice for His Holiness. The first being, now, if I link to you, you must link back to me.
There are rules of reciprocation, says Elizabeth Scalia. Scalia, no relation to the justice, writes a blog called The Anchoress, which appears on the website of the Catholic magazine First Things. She adds, the Pope should aim high.
He should try to get linked by the bigger blogs. He should try to be linked by, for example, Instapundit and the Huffington Post. Because if he gets the exposure there, then he can up his blog ad rates.
Presumably, ad revenue is not high on the Pope's list, although there are a few bankrupt dioceses in the United States that could use some money. Scalia says while blogging is not heavy lifting, the Pope should prepare himself for the unrelenting pressure to post.
You have to blog every day, and he's an 80-something-year-old guy, so maybe he's not always going to want to blog. So he should have some videos, some favorite YouTube videos that he can just slap up there when he's feeling kind of tired, you know, like the parade scene from Ferris Bueller. Slap that up there, and that's a day's blogging.
Of course, a blogging pope would also have to adjust to the style of the Internet. Benedict is a German theologian famous for his long academic treatises peppered with footnotes. How to adapt?
Think hot links and not footnotes.
Father Jim Martin.
He can, if he wants to, he can write a couple paragraphs on, say, St. Augustine or Origen or St. Athanasius, and instead of having, you know, 50 footnotes, have 50 hot links, and people tend to like that on the blogosphere.
Martin has another piece of advice. Be charitable. The Internet can be vicious, but he must refrain from ad hominem attacks. So, should the Pope allow comments?
Only if he has a thick skin. I would say there's two kinds of angry people. There's angry people, and then there's religiously angry people. And the religiously angry people tend to be angrier than the angry people.
Still, David Weinberger sees some dangers ahead. Weinberger writes about politics and culture on his Joho the blog. He says if the Pope wants to spread the Christian message, he might be surprised at the result.
Putting a message out over the internet is exactly the same thing as losing total control of your message. People take it up, they republish it, they make fun of it, they contextualize it. The simple message becomes incredibly complex.
Which raises the question, can something as nuanced as God's word be tweeted?
Trying to boil things down into tweetable form has a long history.
Weinberger cites a theologian of his own tradition, Moses, and his Ten Commandments. Don't murder, don't lie, don't steal, etc. They easily fit into Twitter's 140-character limit. And what about the Sermon on the Mount? Well, that'll require a hyperlink. Barbara Bradley Haggerty, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.